We are almost finished with this course. And in this segment, we are going to talk about some of the things that we don't know about early Christian women in their context, and we wish we did. So it will be somewhat about families and somewhat about the women themselves. 5 points, 5 questions. First one was, how was baptism understood? And how and where was it done? Were children baptized? This is something that's very debated. We just don't have good evidence. Infant baptism, children baptism, adult baptism, we don't know. And this, of course, involved women heavily because it had to do with life in the family, and it had to do with how women were going to live out their baptism and how they participated in it. So the whole question of baptism, we do know that it was by immersion, that it was done that way, and it is based on a ritual of immersion that was developed in Judaism. And there is, of course, ritual purification, which was also adapted as an initiation rite, especially for women who would not be circumcised. The Christian group adopted that and adapted it into the ritual of baptism. But how did it involve women? And we've already seen that by the 3rd century, when the ritual of baptism is highly developed, that the anointing of women, the anointing of the body of the newly baptized, was done. We're not sure exactly how. Certainly head, hands, and presumably feet, which would mean that practically you got to get out of that water and walk up the steps to have your feet anointed. So the role of deaconesses, that was so important for the role of deaconesses to be able to do that with women. But also, once baptized, what was the continuing instruction? Was it different for women than it was for men? Did they, as is done in some traditional societies, instruct women differently because presumably women had different responsibilities in the household? These are just open questions that we wish we knew the answer to, and we don't. 2nd question, what motivated these women to take on and join roles of leadership? What motivated women, first of all, to even become Christian, which is a subset of what motivated anybody to become Christian, men as well. And I think that there were a number of things. I think that one issue was the promise of life after death, ongoing life in some way, of full life restored. Now, they were not the only group that had those kinds of promises. There were some other religious groups that had ideas about continuing life after death. But the Christian way of talking about that in the light of the resurrection of Christ, I think, must have been very appealing. I think a number of other things, other reasons, were there as well. I think one of them was the ongoing solidarity and support that communities showed for each other, the way they looked out for each other. And I think that that whole motivation of joining a group that was solid, that was strong, that would stick by each other. I think that those were some of the main reasons why anybody was motivated to join this group. And women particularly Because I think there must have been some kind of a camaraderie, some kind of an understanding that women were in this together. And again, not in a unique way that would exist in any really happy group of people. But I think that they must also have felt a strong motivation of sisterhood. So I think those are some of the elements that motivated women. But why take on leadership? Well, because it was something that was happening in the society. There were women who were in business. There were women patrons. And to extend that into their life of faith, I think, made perfect sense. So these are some of the motivations, I think, for why women would join this group and take on leadership. Third one is, how did families negotiate the multiple religious allegiances? We've asked this question a bit before. I had said that one model for joining the group was that a whole household would come in together, but there's plenty of evidence that it happened differently as well, that there were wives who became Christians without their husbands. Interesting, I can't think of an example of a husband without the wife, but there probably that happened as well. And there were slaves who joined the group without their slave owners and the rest of the household. Don't know about children. There may have been children, but probably not without their parents. If parents came, probably the children came, and vice versa. But we do know particularly of husbands and wives who one is a member and the other one isn't. And how did they negotiate all those different religious allegiances within their own life, within family life? It's something that we wish we knew more about, and particularly with regard to slaves, when they come into a house church meeting, are they seated along with their household, or are all the slaves in the back? Which would have been the normal thing, actually, in most cases, outside of a Christian context, that the slaves would be back there, and they'd kind of get the last of the servings of the food, you know. Is that the way they did it? Or did they integrate slaves into their household group and say, we're all together here, we're all the same? And if so, when they came home, they went back to the other way of doing it. So how did they deal with all these differences? And I did say something about Tertullian's treatise to his wife and the differences he spells out, that if she were, as a Christian, to marry a non-believer, there would be all of this disjointed activity in the household where she wants to do one thing and he wants her to do something else, and that it would just, his argument is that it just wouldn't work. But we know people were doing it that way. We can see that in 1 Corinthians 7. So that disjointedness was already happening. With the hope, I know, that the Christian members were hoping to convert others in their household. And you have that argument in 1 Peter 2, that the believing wife of the unbelieving husband, by her virtue, by her submission, by her doing things the right traditional way, might convert her husband. You have an example of that even... much, much later, remember that Augustine's mother, Monica, was a Christian. His father was not. And by her holiness, by her virtuous behavior, really pretty much persuaded Augustine's father to become a believer. So you have an example there of how that worked. And I find that really interesting. This is a little sidetrack, but I find that interesting that there, wifely submission is a missionary strategy. It is to conform oneself to the social expectations with the hope of bringing about the conversion and therefore of being the missionary. And remember, remember these women we've looked at just recently now, who actually converted the husband or was the teacher of the husband, was the leader, in Macrina's case, converting her brother, her younger brother, that and not by submission in this case, but by living the integrity of their lives, they were able to bring about conversion. So they really are missionaries when they do that. They're evangelizing. So all of that is involved in those multiple religious allegiances that they had to live with, and that perhaps you do as well. So if you do, then there's nothing new about that. The fourth point is, how was leadership exercised? And we've been looking at that from different perspectives. And we have some idea, we have some general ideas of how it happened. I haven't gone into theories of the development of organized ministry. Just briefly, what we think happened was that, let's say we have a number of house churches in a city. They have some kind of mutual organization. Maybe they have a committee meeting once a month or something, where a delegate or a leader from each of the house churches goes, and they meet together, and then they come back and they tell the news. And eventually, there is someone who is delegated as a superintendent, or, you know, an overseer, a coordinator, whatever you want to call them, for all of these house churches. And that person probably has a title, episcopos, which is superintendent or overseer. And eventually, that evolves into what we then know as the bishop, the monarchical organizer. And as Christian meeting and worship moves out of the household context into a larger gathering in more of a hall context, and that's happening certainly in the second century, then you have this one figure who emerges as a leader of all of the Christians of that city. And then you move into the structure of bishop and presbyters and deacons and deaconesses. So that's kind of a nutshell of how we think it all evolved. But it didn't all just happen overnight. It didn't just say suddenly everybody in every city is doing this. It all happened very gradually and responded to the needs that were there. So how are women involved in this? Women certainly were, as we've seen, some of the first leaders, the hosts of house churches especially. And as the meeting, the Christian meetings, evolved out of the house context into the public larger group, I think the leadership of women lost out, because in the larger public context, the expectation in most cases was for male leadership. Then you have the arising of the deaconesses, who are a particular kind of ministry, and that's a new flourishing of women's ordained ministry. And there are some historical purists who want to say that the ordination of deaconesses was not the same as the ordination of deacons, but you know, really, the evidence suggests that it was. The prayer is different, but slightly different. But really, that they were both what we would say sacramentally ordained, I think is pretty clear, and I think it is to most historians of this development. I'm always tempted to think that when someone goes against the grain of a majority interpretation in an issue like that, especially related to gender, that it's not so much an intellectual conviction as it is, this is the way I would prefer to keep it, that there was some, that there's some kind of perhaps unconscious wanting fear of change and wanting to keep things the way they are, or keep things in a more negative sense with regard to gender equity. And the final question, how they negotiated between expectations of public and private life. Public and private are terms that, at least in the West, have specific meanings today. The house is private, business is public, public libraries, public parks, etc. I haven't said anything about this before, but the understandings of public and private were quite different then, because a lot of business was really carried on in elite households, was carried on in the household. And the notions of public and private were much more fluid. Public had to do with politics, where you bought your food in the market. That was not a public thing. Public meant politics. So the meanings are different. But at the same time, they did have to negotiate between those two worlds. And there's been a number of studies on this. When Christians met in a house church, did they understand that as public or private? And if it was private as household, the leadership of women is natural and it is not questioned. To the extent that they understand it as public leadership was male. And that would possibly be behind some of the resistance that we get even in the Pauline letters and a little bit later, resistance to female leadership. It has been argued by some that it's because they see this meeting of the house church, because people are coming in from elsewhere than the household itself, that they're seeing this as public, and therefore there's resistance to the leadership of women. Well, be that as it may, these are all some unanswered questions, and I'm sure that you have many others yourself. These are the ones that occur to me now at this time, and I share them with you.